Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tonight, let's talk language, specifically bad language. We don't get a chance to discuss profanity on the radio very often, but tonight we can because of the outstanding work of author Benjamin Bergen and his new book, What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. In the book, Bergen looks at all kind of vulgar language and how certain swear words play out in different cultures, how definitions of these words have morphed, and how humans have used these words to both attack and cope throughout time. Benjamin Bergen is a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego, and he was just in town to speak at the Chicago Humanities Festival, and he is my guest tonight at the big table. Benjamin, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
This is my pleasure.
This book is so good. So good. I just want to say
something.
I've been looking forward to this. So you say that this is a love letter to profanity. Where does this come from?
Well, you know, I'm just a guy. In addition to being a professor and stuff, I'm just a person who uses language in all of the normal ways. And I think, like a lot of people who really love language and love its expressive potential and love to be creative with it, I enjoy all of its different manifestations, and that includes profanity. And in addition, as someone who's also a relatively new father, I've been confronted with lots of questions about whether profanity is exactly the right thing to use in all circumstances. What are the limits on it? What are my personal limits? What does the science say about whether we should be using it around kids and what it does to their brains as they're growing up? And so to me, this is just a fascinating area of research. And I started to dig into it a little bit as someone who works on language and the brain and discovered that there is stuff there. We don't really talk about it in public, like you said, but there's a science there.
It's amazing to me, too. And a lot of the premise for the book is how there have been many studies about language and profanity always kind of gets cast to the side. Almost that this is a slice of language that we don't necessarily need to research. But as you say, it's very important. It might be vulgar. It may be hurtful. It may be disgusting, but it is important. Vulgar language is important to the language.
Would you study biology without sexual reproduction? Like, that's kind of the thing. Like, we don't talk about sex that much in formal context like this, but you really wouldn't understand much about biology if you didn't focus on that. And I think it's kind of the same thing with language. There's all kinds of stuff that profanity reveals about the brain, about how we develop language, how it changes over time, that you just wouldn't get if you stuck to the clean stuff.
And it's so interesting because it does follow a lot of scientific research, for instance, and we'll get into this throughout the hour. I love that profanity follows patterns throughout history, that you will see certain words pop up and then disappear and then come back and the meaning changes. But it does follow almost a scientific pattern when you think about how it plays a role in language.
Yeah, that's right. The words that are profane in one generation may completely disappear in the next generation. There are certain trends, like you said, there are certain places that they tend to come from, certain aspects of our human experiences that we find so taboo that the words that describe those experiences, those become profanity. And that's true across languages and across cultures and across time.
Which part of this was the most exciting for you? Because we're going to get into it. But was it the idea of researching certain words, the language part of it, just the consonants and the sounds that we've seen even from the English and the German languages and how they've split? Or was it how the brain interacts and uses and how it responds to this kind of language? For you as a cognitive scientist, what was the most exciting part of this research?
To me, it's the brain science. You know, we know that there are people who have trouble using language because they have strokes or traumatic brain injury. And swearing seems to work differently in those people from the rest of language. We didn't really know why for a very long time, and we're starting to discover exactly what the brain is doing when you swear and how that's different from what it's doing for us right now, producing rational, intentional language and understanding it.
Let's talk about that, because there's a great part in the book about I think it was a 19th century priest who had figured out from the language that was used accidentally, essentially how swearing works around the brain and aphasia. Aphasia is the terminology. Tell this story. This is a great story about how you learned a little bit about how swearing kind of plays out in the brain.
Right. So there was a French neuroscientist by the name of Jacques Lorda, like you said, in the 19th century in Montpellier, France. And he studied language and studied the brain, and then he had a stroke. And he lost the ability to speak. He had aphasia. He eventually recovered, but he dedicated the rest of his career to studying people who were just like him. And one of the most important case studies that I discovered, although 150 years late, I guess, was that of a parish priest. He's this man of God who suffered a stroke, lost all of language with the exception of two words, the word je, which means I, and then a second word, which Lord Da wrote was a word which begins with F and which our dictionaries have never deemed suitable to print. And it's the French F word.
Those are the two words.
The two words, I and this F word, and he's a priest. And this is now relatively well known among aphasiologists that when you have damage to your brain that knocks off those parts of the brain that are especially human and abstract and do complex reasoning and complex language that we don't share with other species, and you lose language, still you preserve swearing. And we're starting to discover why. And it's precisely that spontaneous swearing, that emotional expression of your immediate experience, you know, when you stub your toe or when someone, for example, maybe a spectator at a baseball game catches a what would potentially be a game-changing drive or something like that.
Right.
When you express your emotions immediately through language, that uses a different system of the brain.
Yeah, it's almost like the ums and the ahs, the likes and the weird words we use to fill time. Swear words fall into those categories.
Yeah, it's a part of the brain that's very, very old that we share not just with other primates, but other vertebrates in general. You mice have it. You know, when your dog vocalizes to express emotions, when she yelps or barks or snarls, she's using this other system of the brain, this emotion-driven vocalization system that we seem to have too. We've got two ways to talk. We've got the new, complex, combinatorial, rational part, and then we've got this really immediate, emotional, expressive part, and they can be separately affected by brain trauma.
And this thought that we may have an internal editor, this concept that somewhere in the human brain there is an editor at the end of the factory line before the sentence comes out that scans to make sure that you're not using the wrong words. And sometimes that goes away when you have an emotional response or you stub your toe because you use this word, you throw it out without thinking. But that there is this way that we communicate and the way that we use language, that the brain has a whole system in how we talk.
That's right. So we know that you are unconsciously monitoring what's about to come out of your mouth. And we know that because of profanity. So if you were to believe what Sigmund Freud said, let's say, you would believe that when people make speech errors, when they screw up their words, that it's mostly because they're thinking about something that they don't want to be talking about. It comes out, right? That's a Freudian slip. But actually, when you look at the statistics on it, the speech errors that people make are actually disproportionately not Freudian. They're disproportionately not taboo. People don't slip up and say bad words. They slip up and say non-bad words. And that, with a bunch of neuroscience and a bunch of sort of psychological research, has shown us that, in fact, you've got a monitor in there. That monitor is judging, that thing that you're about to say, that's going to be a bad word, better put on the brakes. And that's stopping people from making as many Freudian slips as you would expect.
It blows my mind. And, you know, I think about it as my profession. I am a talk show host. I'm on the air and I broadcast for a living. I have to make a conscious decision because if you knew me at home, you know, like I just got off a ship, you know, I'm swearing like a sailor. But I don't bring it here. There's a focus to say that I'm not allowed to do that on air. And it's interesting to think about how my brain works to essentially have an internal editor to make sure that I don't slip into and say a word that I'm not supposed to say.
You know, when we stick people in brain scanners, we can actually see how the brain is doing it. And it's doing it in a very similar way to how you inhibit other sorts of things that you might otherwise naturally do. So let's say you're at a stoplight and the light turns green and you're about to go. You're about to release the brake, step on the gas, and then all of a sudden you hear a siren coming from the side. Okay, now you got to stop. Right? You've got to stop what you would normally be doing. Well, the brain systems that do that stopping, that inhibit what you would normally, your normal behavior, same systems that you're using when you inhibit yourself from naturally, spontaneously producing a word that you think, oh, maybe in this context, maybe not the right setting.
Best conversation ever. Benjamin Bergen's in studio. His book is called What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. Just in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. He's a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. We'll take a quick break. We come back. We'll talk about how we choose the words that we put into that emotional bucket as swear words. The history of these swear words and where they come from is as fascinating as anything. Benjamin Bergen in studio tonight at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, the author of the book, What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves, is in studio. Benjamin Bergen, who is a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. He's just in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. There's so much in this book, and we talked a lot about the brain part of the book, but then just gets into the history of where swear words come from, why we use the words we use. You really do a great job of going back into history to find the origins of some of these words. And it's interesting because there's a lot of categories that are in the book, but we'll take four to talk about in the second segment. There's slurs, ethnic slurs, other slurs that we know, huge part of swearing, bodily fluids, of course, sexuality, and religion. Religion is one that, let's start there, because you think of the words holy. Even Jesus, in a way, has changed in the way what it means. But there is a whole collection of swear words that come out of religion. Talk about this.
Well, this is probably the original source of what we think of as profanity. Profanity itself, the word profanity comes from profanus, which means outside of the temple. And in many languages, especially languages associated with strong religious cultures, these are the words that are strongest, most offensive, most powerful. In English, it's not true across the board anymore. In the deep history of English, say before the 18th century, those were absolutely the strongest words in the language. We don't really use them much anymore. They're the ones that you mentioned. But we don't say things like gadzooks,
right.
which comes from God's hooks, which is, you know, a Jesus reference. We don't use that anymore. But in other languages, certainly they do. In Quebecois, for example, just across the border, the strongest words are religious terms from Catholic tradition. So the words for chalice, the words for other liturgical concepts are among the strongest words in Italian, in Spanish. Their strongest profanities are religious, and it's not surprising given the long history and tradition of the Catholic Church in those languages. But yes, it spreads and changes over time. So in the course of history of American English, yes, it was religious terminology for a while, and then language revolving around sex, mostly, starting in maybe the 19th century, became verboten, and people were, with these Victorian attitudes, didn't want to talk about sex in public, and even the F word rose to prominence as a vulgar term in the 19th century, really wasn't profane before that.
You pointed out, and rightfully so, that anything that is considered taboo in our society, that's usually where the vulgarities or the profanity will play, meaning if it's a taboo word, it's usually because it's a taboo subject.
Yeah, that's right. We wall off rooms inside of our houses for sexual activities and for bathroom activities, and so it's not surprising that those activities, which are themselves taboo, would transfer the taboos from the world to the word that describes those things.
It's so interesting. And the religion part, you're right. Words like gadzooks, it's something that you would think you'd only find in comic books for kids. I would never think that that would be an origin swear word, that that would be something that if uttered in mixed company, people would be like, oh, I can't believe you said that. It's just there's so many of those words that have been left behind that have lost their meaning that used to be super offensive.
I hate to give you some bad news, but, you know, you're maybe around my age. I'm in my early 40s. So it turns out that even the words that we think are really bad are on their way out.
Really?
Yeah. So when you do surveys with, you know, millennials and younger Americans, you find that the words that, say, were in George Carlin's list of the 7 words you can't say on television, not even in the top 10. So the strongest words, according to younger Americans, are, in fact, slurs. They're really offended by words that denigrate by ethnicity, sex, sexual orientation, that sort of thing, ability. And the F word is number 13 on the list.
That's hard to believe. The 42 years old, 43, you know, I feel like there would never be any replacement for the F word. That would be in the top three. That's like to hear that it's 13th among younger generations is startling.
But this is the treadmill that these words are on. They start off as being mundane, everyday words. That same word, the F word, during Shakespeare's time would have been just a sort of run-of-the-mill term. And it, again, rose to prominence as profanity with the Victorian attitudes that arose in the 19th century. And it's starting to dribble back down the charts.
And being just thinking of intergenerational, when you get to a certain point, you hear words being used. I think of the word gay. Is a good example in our generation where you heard it being referenced, that you hear it in old Shakespeare, where the word gay, it meant something different, meant happy. right, than what we knew. The word Dick is another one where there was a whole generation of people named, that was their nickname, Dick Nixon, Dick Van Dyke. And today, anyone who would be named Richard or Rich would never shorten their name to Dick.
Right. And I think that's true. So we've got in the book, I did a little survey. I looked at the Social Security Administration's naming database to actually track that there are no children who are given the name Dick since like 1970 as their given name in the U.S. But there appears to be a little bit of not backlash, but a little bit of reverberation there, because that term, you know, it was more offensive 20 years ago than it is now.
Right.
It's fallen down the charts as well. And so younger Americans don't really think
they don't see it as a derogatory in any form.
It's a little bit derogatory, but they don't.
But not, yeah, top 10. Right?
Not to the point that it's so offensive that they wouldn't use it as a nickname. And so there are actually some younger people, high school kids, for example, who think that it's a perfectly reasonable thing to call themselves. It's as if the word had impact at a moment in time. It affected naming practices because, well, you know, it's this word for genitalia and you don't want to call your baby boy genitalia. And then as that meaning started to disappear, so did the biases against using
it as a name. That is the power of this book and the power of this discussion is just this idea of meaning and weight and how certain words that we may know mean something else to different generations and they follow this pattern. It's fascinating to me to think about some of the words that you and I grew up with that we could never say that have different meanings now. They don't actually mean the same things that they meant to other people.
Yeah. So among the most offensive words to younger Americans is a word that starts with R. They call it the R word. It's used for people who have mental disabilities.
Interesting, yeah.
And growing up on the playground, that just meant idiot. You're just a dummy.
Thrown about with no issue whatsoever.
And boy, that's one of the worst things that you could call someone in my freshman seminars, for example.
Interesting. In studio tonight, Benjamin Bergen. He's the author of What the F, What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. He is a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego, was just in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. We'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll continue the conversation tonight at Big Table with Benjamin Bergen. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, we're talking with Benjamin Bergen. He's the author of What the F, What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. He's a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. He was just in town at the Chicago Humanities Festival. We're really talking about language, but we're talking about profanity. You mentioned at the beginning about kids. This is the third part of this conversation, really about the emotional baggage or the weight of what profanity plays in our world, stress, other things. We've talked about slurs. Slurs, you know, has an impact on a younger mind and frankly, everybody. But there is, when we start talking about how vulgar language affects kids, it shifts a little bit.
So there's this pervasive belief that any profanity around kids is going to harm them. You know, what things that you hear, or maybe they're going to have a stunted vocabulary, or maybe they're going to become more aggressive if they hear aggressive language around them, or maybe they just won't figure out the right context to use those words, and that's going to look bad in public when they use it in school.
Absolutely.
And there's really not any evidence for any of those things. So when you look at it, when you look at the end point of that sort of childhood of learning, when the 18-year-olds show up in my lab, you don't find that the more frequent swearers or the better swearers are less intelligent or less proficient with language or less able to control their emotions. In fact, to the extent that there's any correlation, it's the reverse. People who are really proficient with profanity tend to be more proficient with language in general, and that results in higher...
That is the reverse. A lot of people believe that you are a lazy intellect, or you have a lazy intellect if you're using swear words.
My best interpretation of it is that language is language, and that people who are creative and proficient with language find it in all of its different manifestations. So that stuff isn't true. But certainly what is true is that verbal abuse is harmful. Kids suffer from depression, anxiety, they have trouble in school when there are people, including classmates, but also caregivers, who say things to them that make them believe that they're worthless or that they are going to be physically harmed. And that doesn't have to be profanity. It can include profanity.
Right.
And slurs certainly do that work. There's been a couple of studies showing that children in junior high schools who are most addressed using slurs, the studies that I've seen are always homophobic slurs, mm-hmm. are most likely to show changes in their ability to cope with school and anxiety and depression and so on.
It leads to stress. The brain reacts, the emotion of being a slur being used against you. There's evidence to show that stress goes up, that there is an emotional response to it.
For sure. So that makes them kind of a special kind of profanity. As for all the rest of the stuff, so, you know, let's say, you know, you're watching a White Sox game, something good happens or something bad happens, and you get really excited and your kid's in the room and you let loose with whatever it is that you let loose with. I know this is Chicago. Plenty, there's probably a lot of letting loose,
yeah, right.
A lot of reason to let loose. So is that going to harm your kid? There's no evidence whatsoever that that's going to cause any harm. And there's also no evidence that kids fail to learn the contexts. I mean, you were saying just now, you have two different linguistic lives, right? You've got what you do at home, and you've got what you do at work, where you have to be very careful about language. Kids learn that. I have a four-year-old. 2 years ago, he knew this is a place that you use the potty. This is a place that you don't use the potty. And language is just like that. They're always learning about shaping their behaviors to context. And by two, by three, by 4 years old, they're very able to figure that out. Maybe a kid is going to experiment a little bit in school, figure out, oh, I see, teacher doesn't like it when I use this word in that context, and they'll learn. They'll figure it out.
You know, we talked about a little bit earlier about the emotional response when it comes to swear words when you stub your toe or other issues, and that's what I want to ask about, because I've seen swear words take on, and I think about sports a lot with this. I'll see like a basketball player makes a huge play, slam dunk, and he's slow motion coming back down the court, and it is a just a barrage of swear words in a positive way, in the way that he's very excited and motivated to win the game for his team, and everyone's cheering. But it is interesting that swear words mean something to all sorts of different situations.
Yeah. Really, the undercurrent is that they're about emotion. And it's not necessarily negative emotions. I mean, that's what we usually tar them with, this negative aura. Like, oh, well, when you're aggressive or when you're angry, when you're frustrated or in pain, you swear. And that's true. You do. But there's lots of work on swearing out of jubilation, swearing as part of sexual arousal. There are all sorts of positive dimensions of swearing as well. I think of it as any sort of powerful tool, right? It's got positive uses, it's got negative uses, it's really what you do with it.
Through time, and we've seen, as you mentioned, basically patterns and history and meanings have changed, but there are some swear words where the weight doesn't change, at least in modern history, and I think of the N-word as a great example of the torment that's associated to that word and the damage that it's done. We talked about the emotional stress of that. It's probably the one word in the English language that is not played with lightly.
Right.
Do you see that with other swear words? There have been times in the history of language, and I think globally, not just here in America with the English language, where words have moved out of the realm of all swear words and moved to the top of the heap?
Well, look, there's a very clear reason why that word is as powerful as it is, and it has nothing to do with language. It has everything to do with the history behind
context,
the use of that word.
Right.
So, and in general, that's what you see, that words take on particular meaning and unique power when there is a history of antagonism behind them. And so you see that during times of war, slurs for, say, Vietnamese people or Korean people, super powerful, or slurs for German people during the Second World War or the First World War. When the circumstances create antagonism, the language that's associated with those circumstances sort of, it indexes it, it points to it. Like, this is a really bad thing that people have done or that people believe, and it's very hard to disentangle the words from that.
I feel like we could talk about this all night, because we haven't gotten to the actual sounds of these words. The CK, the hard K, is very interesting. The passage about the F word and whether or not, you know, some will say it's an acronym at one point, and you chart it all the way back, and you find out it can't be an acronym because the words that the acronym stand for weren't around when it would have come, because you've seen how it plays out in German and Swedish, all these different languages. This is great. And also, another part of this is just the different swear words in the different cultures, because we're all, as human beings, obviously we have different ways that we express ourselves through language, but even before language, there are hand signals, there are facial expressions, there are ways that we were able to emotionally transcend or communicate the same concept of what a swear word is supposed to do through our hands, through our face. So this is something that is not just about how we speak and the words that come out of our mouths, but who we are as humans.
How we express emotions. Yeah, there are undercurrents that run throughout our species. And, you know, maybe the most interesting question that you're kind of getting at is, where does this come from? Like, what's the impulse to swear? Like, why is it that we have profanity at all? Why do we have a middle finger? Not why do we have the finger, but why do we have the gesture that uses the middle finger? And it's possible that this is part of the story of how language came about in our species, right? It's possible that our earliest vocalizations as humans were expressions of emotion, just like what your dog does, you know, get off my lawn kind of expressions,
or
I want to express my affection towards you. And that these expressions, these vocalizations use the pathway that profanity still uses. Maybe profanity, not in its current form, not these specific words, but this kind of use of language is older than the nouns and verbs and complex sentences that we have ultimately over time evolved to be able to express and understand.
That's fascinating. Benjamin Bergen is the author of What the F, What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, Ourselves. He, of course, is a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego, and he was just in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival, and we didn't even swear.
Yeah,
we made it through the whole thing. We did it.
We did it.
Benjamin, thanks so much for being my guest tonight at the Big Table. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Justin.